Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of May. The question this hour is, what does J.P. Morgan's loss of over $2 billion say about the banking industry after the financial collapse? Do we need more regulation of this industry? And how does a large bank like this lose $2 billion? What indeed happened? This is J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon speaking with David Gregory on Meet the Press on Sunday, and it's his response to Gregory's question of whether any laws were broken.
So we've had audit, legal, risk, compliance, and we're best people looking at all of that. We know we were sloppy. We know we were stupid. We know there was bad judgment. We don't know if any of that's true yet. Now, of course, regulators should look at something like this. That's their job. So, you know, we are totally open kimono with regulators, and they will come to their own conclusions. But we intend to fix it, learn from it, and be a better company when it's done.
President Obama yesterday said we don't know all the details. It's going to be investigated, but this is why we passed Wall Street reform. This hour of the program, we'll talk about, is this sloppy and stupid? Are they words that will make an effort to make this law sound like a one-time thing? Or is there indeed a systemic problem? Is it keeping investors from the Wall Street from investing these days? We have two guests with us this hour, and we're going to have a lot of phone calls, I can tell right off the bat. Mark Williams is one of our guests. Mark is executive in residence, master lecturer at Boston University School of Management, and is a former Federal Reserve Bank examiner. And Roger Lowenstein, a columnist for Bloomberg, author of The End of Wall Street and When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management. Mark, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi, and Roger, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you please explain to me how a bank can lose $2 billion? What happened, and it may be more than $2 billion, what happened to that money?
Great.
Let me pick up on that?
Go ahead, Roger.
Sure. Apparently what happened in this case is, you know, banks take risks, so let's not forget that banks are in the business of taking risk, meaning every time someone walks in for a loan, if they give a loan, they're taking a risk, and we want banks to do that. In this case, although we don't know everything, we know that J.P. Morgan has plenty of loans outstanding to Europe, and people were, obviously, they've been worried on and off, mostly on about Europe. And at some point, what seems to have happened is J.P. Morgan said, gee, you know, we've got loans to countries in Europe, we have loans to companies in Europe, let's buy a little insurance so that, you know, if Europe really goes down, you know, we're protected. And they went into the derivatives market, and a particular type of instrument, which is, you know, we should talk more about, but let's just say they went into the derivatives market and they bought some insurance the same way you'd buy, you know, auto insurance or fire insurance or whatever. And then sometime later, these fellows decided, you know, there's really not that much risk. So the exposure that we protected ourselves against, we want to reverse that. You know, now we'd actually like to be exposed to the risk in Europe. We don't really think it's going to be that bad. And they went back to the same derivative instrument, and they reversed the trade, or they tried to, but it didn't match up. And this second stage really just amounted to you know, rolling the dice in Europe when they thought things in Europe were going to improve. And now, once again, we have these headlines of, you know, the election in France and Greece and uncertainty in Spain and so on. So these trades are losing a lot of money.
Mark, this all sounds sort of complicated to me, and we'll talk about derivatives later. But is this something that big banks should be doing? Is it okay to do this?
Well, I think what's happened with J.P. Morgan is really brought to light that very important question. What we do know is that the top five banks, when I say top, meaning the biggest banks, they represent about 95% of this derivative industry. You know, the derivatives themselves, they trade around the world, and that sized market is over $700 trillion. If we were having this conversation back in the 1980s, it would have been approximately $1 billion in derivatives. So it's a significant industry. These instruments, if not used correctly, can actually blow up and cause great losses. So it is a very good question. Should the top five banks that control the majority of this industry be trading these instruments, especially if they're actually government FDIC-insured deposits that they're using or actually benefiting from to profit? So My general feeling is no. I feel, in particular, these banks have a responsibility to the communities or the larger regions that they serve, and that is to take in deposits and make loans. When they start speculating, like what J.P. Morgan did, and take losses of $2 billion or $3 billion or $4, then that actually steps out of the realm of commercial banking, and it gets into this realm of basically gambling.
Do you agree with that, Roger?
I do. I do. You know, what the type of gambling of derivatives that J.P. Morgan was fooling around with, it is very akin to insurance. They were, I'll just burden you with one term, selling credit default swaps, which means that people who were worried about Europe coming to them, and they were saying, you know, give us a little money now, and if anything bad happens, you know, we'll pay you a whole lot of money later, the same way you'd go to you know, Allstate or somebody and say, I'll give you a little bit of money now. If my house burns down, you build me a new one. And that type of contract works very well generally in a regulated insurance environment where, you know, in each state, the insurance commissioners look and see how many homes you're insuring and what your capital base is and whether the ratios are correct and so on. What's happened with derivatives is we have a sort of a shadow insurance market grown up without this kind of regulation. And also, you know, as much as I like Mark, I can't take insurance out on his house. And if I did take a policy out on his house, he'd probably get worried, you know. Why are you laying wood chips around my front lawn, you know? But that's what happens in derivatives. People take, you know, quote, insurance policies out on other people's houses, other people's companies, other people's countries. And of course, you know, that just amounts to gambling.
So why are banks doing this? They will make a lot of money from it? They may make a lot of money from it?
Right. It's as straightforward as that. It's a very profitable business. If we look back at the top five banks again, and for your listenership, the top five banks, we're not just talking about J.P. Morgan, but we're talking about B of A and Goldman Sachs and Citi and also Wells Fargo. If we look at these top banks, with a lesser extent of Wells, they made a roughly $25 billion in trading these type of derivatives in the last 2 years. So it's high profit for them. So as a result, they don't want to give this up. It's risky, but with that risk comes high profit. And that really gets to the point of J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan truly didn't understand the sophistication or level of risk they were taking. Although they convey that they're a very sophisticated shop, clearly that these risks that they took, they did not understand until they lost $2 to $3 billion.
Now, the last go around when we had the huge financial collapse a few years ago, a lot of people had pension money. A lot of people lost a lot of their savings money. Did people, the average person who is counting on retirement funds or college funds, et cetera, lose any money in this loss by J.P. Morgan?
I don't think so. I mean, the stock is going, their stock is going down, but I think, you know, it's going down a considerable amount. It's gone down, I guess, 10% since this broke, but I think the stock has gone down more due to the uncertainty and the confusion and, you know, fear maybe there's something else. But to be fair, the amount of money that they've got, $2 trillion in assets, you know, so the $2 billion loss will not, you know, the old line, a billion here, a billion there, sooner or later it's real money, but it's not a significant loss for J.P. Morgan. So, and it seems as though a lot of hedge funds that, you remember those fine
right.
fellows, hedge funds, well, they ganged up on the other side of the trade, and that $2 billion didn't disappear. So someone made money on the other side of those trades, and that wouldn't have been ordinary investors that you mentioned.
Yeah, but I think J.P., though, there's a big lesson here. J.P. Morgan, the trade loss were $2 to $3 billion, but their market cap, that is the value of the stock, dropped by approximately $30 to $35 billion so far. And I think that's a wake-up call for J.P. Morgan in particular, I'm sure, for its board and risk management department, its actually subcommittee, risk management committee, to say, you know, this was excessive risk. We've got to rethink our business model. And I think in part that's why the stock has also dropped, because if they can't make big bets going forward, then the company is valued less going forward as well.
And Roger, when you say somebody made money, who made money?
It seems it's always hard to tell who's the other side of a trade, but the anecdotal reports are that hedge funds, privately owned, you know, basically their investors rich individuals and institutions and so on, they were on the other side of these trades. So presumably they were the ones who, you know, collectively somehow, you know, are $2 billion to the richer.
Let's hear the response from President Obama and from Mitt Romney. I'm interested in your response to how they responded to this loss of over $2 billion. The president taped in an interview yesterday on The View. Part of it aired on ABC News last night. And here is some of what President Obama said.
J.P. Morgan is one of the best managed banks there is. Jamie Dimon, the head of it, is one of the smartest bankers we got. And they still lost $2 billion in counting. Precisely because they were making bets in these derivative markets. We don't know all the details yet. It's going to be investigated. But this is why we passed Wall Street reform. This is the best or one of the best managed banks.
Right.
You could have a bank that isn't as strong, isn't as profitable, making those same bets, and we might have had to step in.
And this is Eric Fernstrom, senior Romney advisor, speaking on the Today Show this morning.
Look, there will be companies that take risks. Not every risk turns out to work for the investors in a company. In a case like the one that before us now with J.P. Morgan, there is accountability. People will be held to account for the losses that occurred. There was no taxpayer money at risk. All of the losses went to investors, which is how it works in a public market.
I hear that, and I think pretty stark differences between these two people on what just happened. What do you think, Mark?
Right. Well, it's fascinating. I'll start with sort of the Mitt Romney camp response. They define it as risk. I define it as excessive risk. They talk about accountability, meaning that the chief investment officer who made $14 million last year is now fired. You know, that's not accountability. This is a bank that needs to be accountable to its shareholders. Their shareholders lost a value of $35 billion. So how are they accountable? You know, the Obama camp, I think, gets it right. They're talking about bets. These were bets. They were losses that were made. Up to now, many have thought J.P. Morgan was well managed. They also thought Jamie Dimon was the smartest guy in the room, which we're all realizing maybe he's not. Maybe he's mortal. So I think when we look at the combination, it's really a debate about, and it shouldn't be a political issue, right? When the financial crisis happened in 2008, Republicans and Democrats alike were in the same boat that sank. So it really should be more of a policy structural issue. What is the role of commercial banks to get FDIC insurance? Is that role to make loans, or is that role also to speculate and gamble?
Roger, is it a political issue from hearing those comments?
Of course it's a political issue because politicians or regulators that they appoint are the ones who implement the rules, and elected representatives are the ones who legislate the rules. I would say, let's see, a lot of things to respond to, but in response to Obama in particular, to the president, you know, it's true that this is why we passed the legislation, but right now there is a terrific fight going on at the Securities and Exchange Commission and another agency, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, about how derivatives, and remember this, all these losses occurred in derivatives, should be regulated. And the banks, including J.P. Morgan, are in there lobbying vociferously. And frankly, the administration has been caving on one issue after another. They've given no support to the agencies to let them really hang out to dry. And as a result, the rules, as they're emerging, are going to be a lot looser than people who favor more supervision of derivatives had hoped. So I think the president, is talking tough in that quote, but the actions of his administration have not backed it up.
And caving because they're getting campaign contributions from these very people?
Caving because it's a tough issue politically. The campaign contributions are coming in. He's picking his battles. He recently signed the so-called jobs bill, which rolled back regulations on what companies must disclose and so on when they go public. Caving because he doesn't seem, I'm not a psychiatrist, but he doesn't seem to want to be portrayed by Mitt Romney and so on as too much in favor of regulation going into a campaign. But for whatever reason, cave he has.
Mm-hmm. Mark, why do you think he's caving?
Right. I think because of political pressures. In essence, the economy hasn't come back the way he had hoped soon. We still have high unemployment, over 8%, 8.1%. And I think, you know, no sitting president has been reelected with unemployment over 7.4% since FDR was president. So, you know, the economy is very important. If you look at the banking sector itself, the banking sector represents a large percentage of our GDP and growth. So they are the engine. And I think the concern is, you know, we want to constrain them and also control their risk-taking, but too much constraint, a straitjacket, would reduce profitability and could make the economy slow down even more.
We welcome phone calls. We have a number of them coming in already. The bank chief executive, Jamie Dimon, who we've been talking about, is also facing shareholders fairly soon at the company's annual meeting, which happens to take place today. And I'm wondering what both our guests will think will be, what will be asked and what they would ask at that shareholders meeting. Our phone number, one line open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and leave messages on this, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking this hour about J.P. Morgan Chase announcing last Thursday a $2 billion trading loss, and we're talking about how that could happen. Aren't we supposed to be regulating banks right now? What about banks' involvement in derivatives market? And we'll talk more about what that market is. Here to join us to answer all of this and their mighty fine guests, Mark Williams, executive in residence, master lecturer at Boston University School of Management. He is a former Federal Reserve Bank examiner, and Roger Lowenstein, columnist for Bloomberg, author of The End of Wall Street and When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Tuesday, the author of Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Our guest is the author of that book. He's run for several races himself, for several seats in Congress and other races, and has worked as a senior policy and communications advisor to a U.S. senator, the governors of Wyoming and California, the mayor of Portland, Oregon, two university presidents, and the bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Cheyenne. And he will be with us to talk about the also-rans, some of whom, nine in particular, he says, were people who made lasting contributions to American democracy. All right, two phone calls. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest. To me, this whole economic debacle was really caused by the changes made by the Clintons when they were in the White House. And so I would be in favor of reversing or modifying almost every piece of legislation that the Clintons either passed or abolished. And that would include the Glass-Steagall Act to separate commercial and investment banking. If we don't need to reinstate it, then we at least need some sort of modified form of that idea. The Clintons deregulated the hedge fund operations and the commodities markets, you know, like gold, for instance. I think we need much more intelligent regulations in fields like that. I think we need to have a conference of maybe 50 of the nation's leading economists to get together to describe the kinds of regulations we need here to protect the American economy and the American people from these high-flying billionaires using our money to engage in their speculative pursuits that can harm the American economy.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Roger.
You know, I agree with some of what the caller says. I'd caution that the Clintons aren't actually an amorphous joined single entity. I think Bill Clinton was president in the late 90s, and Hillary was the first lady. But and I agree that the Commodity Modernization Act of 2000 was a mistake. Also, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, I think, was a mistake. Some of the deregulation that continued under President Bush, I think, was also mistaken. I don't think at all is centered on Clinton or the Clintons.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Laverne in Monroe. Hi, Laverne.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Laverne.
Good morning, Mark and Roger.
Good morning.
Good morning.
They'll be talking about this until election time because of Mitt Romney being private equity. There's too much missing money. There should be a federal investigation to really get down to the bottom of if derivatives have any value. I've been talking about them for 20 years, and I think they're all counterfeit. Until you can put a value on derivatives growing from $1 trillion to over $700 trillion, if they don't look into it, they'll go to $800 or $900 trillion. Mitt Romney's in private equity, and President Obama said he's going to tax the hedge fund dealers. That would bring in revenue. Now, who's got missing money? MF Global has missing money. Now you have the latest incidents. Enron had problems. Madoff had problems. There's 20 books, at least, I've read on this issue. Now, if they can't decide it by the election time, and I don't think they can unless they have a federal investigation. What do you think?
Mark.
Right. Well, I think the caller has a number of good points, and one of them is I like the theme of follow the money. In this case, it's follow the law. So the question then is, how could a sophisticated company such as J.P. Morgan get it so wrong? And the answer, in part, is the fact that they got involved in derivatives that they really didn't understand. So that's an important issue then. Should you be, as a financial institution with FDIC-insured deposits, involved in derivatives that are complicated that you don't understand? So these investigations, yes, they should happen. The SEC already is starting an investigation of trying to understand what happened at J.P. Morgan. I want to caution your listeners, though, in the sense that J.P. Morgan would like the market to think that this was a sort of a rogue event, or that one individual trader or a series of traders just made a bad judgment call. But this was at the highest level. These were trades that were approved at the very, very top of the organization, and that reflects a risk tolerance that is unacceptable for a commercial bank, and that's what happened. So, in essence, I think that also has to be evaluated and discussed, and I think public radio having discussions like this today are very important to get these issues out.
Well, it's absolutely amazing that they didn't really understand what they were doing, because that's what they do. They should understand what's going on, shouldn't they?
Well, absolutely. In part, if you think about this, if these trades had turned out positive, you know, Roger did a nice job of giving a background of these trades, then that profit, these traders would have benefited from it. And the fact that the coin that came up tails and that the banks hurt, some of these traders have lost their job, but that's about it. It's not a sense that there's really a change in the corporate philosophy of how they get involved in these derivatives, and there should be a change.
Right. And will stockholders examine that very issue today, do you think, Roger?
Well, I think they will articulate these concerns. You know, it's not going to be up to the stockholders, except I don't think there was any proxy issue that's developed, you know, too close before the annual meeting. The suggestion has been made that that J.P. Morgan separate the two jobs that Jamie Dimon currently has. One is chief executive, which means he's, you know, running the company, the top person in management, and the other job is chairman of the board, and the chairman of the board is a supervisory position. It's, you know, who is the management accountable to? And I happen to think that, and I've written this, that Jamie, you know, probably is the best banking CEO around, and I think he still is. Nonetheless, I think no one, not even Jamie, can be accountable to himself, and I think that at J.P. Morgan and at any public company, every public company, those two jobs should be separate. You know, Jamie shouldn't be reporting to Jamie. He should be reporting to some independent director selected by the stockholders. To anticipate your next question, I don't think it's going to happen.
Right. I think the losses really point to that weakness, that there's clearly a weakness in philosophy and controls and oversight at J.P. Morgan for this to happen. Lehman Brothers in particular, Dick Fole was the CEO at the time. He was also not only CEO but chairman of the board as well. And if you don't have an extra set of hands and eyes in a process, then I think you increase the chances of excessive risk-taking or excessive losses.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about him being the best and the brightest among the bankers. What about all these other big banks that you just mentioned? Are they doing similar kinds of trading that they don't understand what they're doing either? Are we just seeing the beginning here?
Well, they are. I mean, Mark cited some of the figures in total derivative trading. And that's, you know, it's not all coming from J.P. Morgan. It's coming from Bank of America and Goldman and so on. You know, five or six of them are on at least one side of, you know, a huge proportion of these. It's a very concentrated market. And one of the things that the regulation, the Dodd-Frank law, tried to do was to force the business away from being a specialty business where you'd call up J.P. Morgan or call up Bank of America and make a private contract, and that, and more of an Amazon-type business where you just go online and, you know, see Amazon's price and see BarnesandNoble.com and everybody's price, and it'd be more transparency. Margins would come down. It would be less profitable for the banks, but you know, more economical for the users, the people on the other side, and more transparency. And they have fought this. The banks have fought this. And unfortunately, this is one of the areas that the agencies, without help from the administration, seems to be giving in on.
Thanks, Laverne, for your call. And you have indeed been on this issue for a long time. We thank you for it. Ron in Sparta, hi.
Hi there. This is, I think, much to do about nothing. These investors made billions of dollars, J.P. Morgan also. And now they lost a couple billion dollars. This is investors' money, not taxpayers' money. Look at the Solyndra and the green energy that our federal government invested in and lost billion customers. They're still losing money on it. Who says a thing about that? That's taxpayer money, not private investor money. So we should, you know, we should feel sorry for these investors? Heck no, they took the risk. And fortunately, AIG, if they're smart enough, don't underwrite or insure these companies or insure this kind of derivative investment so the taxpayer ends up with the bill. I'll take your answer off the air.
All right, thanks, Ron. Mark.
Right, so the caller raised a question that was a very important one, and that is who took the loss here? And clearly at this point it looks like investors have taken a substantial loss, much larger than $2 billion, but actually a loss of anywhere between 15 to 20 times that if you look at their market cap that they've lost. Sure, that's very true. Investors have taken a loss, but and taxpayers have not at this point. But the fundamental question from a policy issue is what is the business the bank should be involved in? I'm sure the caller will remember back in the early 1980s, to be a banker was to be boring. Today, if you're in the banking industry, some folks call these people banksters. It's a very high-risk industry all of a sudden, is particularly with the concentrated five banks and the positions of risk they take. So is that the appropriate role of banks? Or should banks be more, for example, like utilities? Should they create stability in the economy? You know, if we look at the overall size of banks, their assets represent roughly 60% of U.S. GDP.
Oh, my goodness.
So what this means is that the strength or weakness of any economy, our economy in particular, is tied so tightly to the strength or weakness in the behaviors, risk-taking behaviors of our banks. So what is the role of banks? And I think that's where this $2 billion trade comes up and is a very important issue to discuss.
Bill in Madison, hi.
This last caller, I think, is just so full of bunk. And the reason why, and I'll take my answer off the air, is that, you know, Republicans and especially libertarians take as an article of faith that capitalism works best when it's free, you know, freedom of burdensome regulations, et cetera, et cetera. The trouble with that is that if allowed to run free, capital concentrates, and so does market share, so does wealth, because companies prey on one another, they merge, they acquire, and eventually you have whole markets controlled by a very few people making decisions that if they turn out wrong, they don't just bring down their investors. They don't just bring down their depositors. They bring down the entire economy.
Roger.
You know, I think that this caller and the previous caller are really debating whether the public has an interest in regulating banks such as J.P. Morgan. Then the previous caller made the point that, well, this is investor money being lost, not taxpayer money, but the experience of 2008 is only what, 4 years ago. It's not 400 years ago. In 2008, the U.S. had to bail out three of the biggest banks we had, Wachovia, Bank of America, and, of course, Citibank. And it had to fold up and find a buyer for one of the, I think, the fourth biggest, which was WaMu. And public money was used, and I believe three of those, in the tune of hundreds of billions. So we know that these banks are so big and so vital that their health is a matter of public interest and can become a matter of public dollars. At the same time, I think it's, you know, the point is well taken that this is a loss for the shareholders, and J.P. Morgan is not a Lehman Brothers. You know, the amount lost was, you know, not going to threaten J.P. Morgan's solvency or health. So we're not talking about another Dick Fuld and Lehman, but we're talking about what kind of, does this point out the need for rules, or to tighten the rules, or to make sure that the rules we thought we legislated are enforced, so that we don't have another Dick Fuld and another Citibank.
I was reading about investors generally, and I was wondering about less buying and selling of stocks, which I've read is going on right now. The interpretation was that investors were concerned that financial reform doesn't seem to be very solid, and they're shying away from Wall Street. How does that play into all of this, Mark? Is that true, and how does that play into all of this?
Well, it's an integral part for an investor to feel comfortable enough to invest their hard-earned money. They're going to have confidence and feel that there's honesty and integrity in the system in which they invest in. You know, when we think about Wall Street, for some reason there's this view, or at least from 2008 it's been, that there's a separation between ethics in finance, that you can't be ethical if you're on Wall Street. And unfortunately, until investors start getting comfortable with the behavior, that is, there's going to be ethical behavior with our biggest banks, I mean, they're the stewards of our economy, then you're not going to see as much capital flowing into the economy. And I think that's what's very important here as well with J.P. Morgan. Right? They were at the very top. Jamie Dimon demonstrated, or at least he told the American people, that he was above the fray. His company didn't get involved in that mess. He wasn't in the mud. But yet, now we're seeing that he was. He was in that risk-taking, excessive risk-taking mud.
Thanks, Bill, for your call. James in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hello. I have two questions. The first question is, why is a default swap obligation, which is fundamentally it's just an insurance policy, why do we permit it to be sold by somebody who is not regulated as an insurance company? I mean, I just simply cannot understand that. Why do we permit them to be sold to people who have no interest in the transaction? For instance, I can't go out and buy a fire insurance policy on your house, but I could go out and buy a default swap obligation on your car loan, let's say. And the reason for that is I could buy the fire insurance policy and then burn your house down and collect it, which is exactly what happened in the derivatives market before the crash a couple of years ago. And the second question is, how can the Romney people claim that there was no taxpayer money involved in J.P. Morgan's recent debacle when, indeed, the taxpayer money was at risk because we have to bail them out if they overdo it? I mean, it's just crazy to me to say that the taxpayers are not involved. Until that industry is separated to the point where there is no possibility that the federal government has to pick up the losses, taxpayer money is at risk. Now, whether or not it actually gets drawn on is another matter. But I mean, it's just absurd logic that's used in some of these statements.
Roger.
Well, To pick up on the first point in particular, I think it's a terrific point. Why are credit default swaps, which again are the derivative market's form of insurance, why are they allowed to be sold by people, companies who aren't regulated as insurers? I can't think of a good reason, which means, in my opinion, there is no good reason. This is what happened to AIG. AIG decided that it didn't think that home mortgages were a big risk. It didn't think that subprime mortgages were a big risk. It didn't think that the securities made from these mortgages or backed by these mortgages were a big risk, so it decided it was going to go out and insure, I think it was $370 billion, if I remember the figure right, and no insurance commission, no insurance regulator, no capital regulator was there to say, well, Mr. AIG, do you have the capital to issue these kinds of insurance policies? You know, it'd be as if, you know, Mark and I just decided, hey, let's go down to the, you know, shore in Cape Cod and insure all the homes down there, and we'll collect everybody's premiums, you know, without anybody asking us, well, do you have the capital to do that? I mean, it's fine when you collect the premiums, but you've got to have the wherewithal to stand behind it. This is a huge, unregulated insurance market, and I don't think it should continue as it is. I think the caller's exactly right.
James, thanks so much for the call. Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I didn't hear the first half of the program, so I may have missed something. And the caller from Sturgeon Bay kind of hit my main point, which was if, you know, and this all has been, we've talked about this now for 3 years since it fell apart, and it just seems so very simple, and I don't know why it doesn't get done unless somebody's lining their pockets, which I'm sure they are. But if firms are too big to fail, no matter what kind of firm it is, so that the government has to bail them out, you just make the firm smaller. It's just a very simple thing. And then you just let capitalism go. And if the company is mismanaged and it goes out of business, well, that's just too bad for the company. But as long as the taxpayer doesn't have to pay, I'm a capitalist. I'm a libertarian. But libertarians aren't necessarily for a lot of government bailouts.
Mark.
Right. So the point here is important, and that point is that if you have too big to fail, then they are too big, right? So then we need to break them up. J.P. Morgan, for example, is $2 trillion in assets. B of A is almost $2 trillion. These two banks alone are significant. I don't think any of your listenership is going to say that Citi or Goldman Sachs or Wells Fargo or J.P. or B of A would not be bought out by the government or rescued because they are too big to fail. The problem we have is we still have a weak global economy. You know the connection of the top five banks and how important that is to the U.S. economy. We cannot break them up at this moment in time. In Europe, Europe is still on fire. The banks in Europe, the majority of those banks themselves are in critical condition. So it would be nice, in a strong economy, it would be perfect. That's the time in which to break these banks up and also charge higher FDIC insurance. That should happen. They should have higher premiums to reflect the higher risk-taking they make. But at this point, we're not at that. But I think from a policy perspective going forward, we need to talk about how to transition the J.P. Morgans and B of A's into smaller banks so we don't have to put taxpayer money at risk.
I'm wondering how, thank you, Ralph, for the call, how the president said that we don't know all the details. It's going to be investigated. Jamie Dimon indicated that they don't know what happened. It was sloppy. There's no excuse for it. It was stupid. He didn't really understand it. We're saying in this hour that nobody really understands what the mistake was. How are we going to ever find out, to keep this kind of thing from happening again, what the mistake was? How do you investigate it when you don't know what it was?
Well, I think they'll get to the bottom of it, pretty quickly. I mean, they were complicated trades, but, you know, there's a paper trail. I know Jamie to be honest and earnest, and when he says, you know, it was our bad and we're going to get to the bottom of it, I believe that he will. And it's not going to take them that long to add up just, you know, who made which trades and why, and then, you know, maybe spend a little time figuring out what the strategies were and interviewing the people involved. But it's they're going to get to the bottom of it. I'm not sure that the mystery is actually that great. I think from what I've read, it seems like a very plausible explanation that as a bank, they're exposed to risk in Europe. They made a bunch of trades to reduce that risk, and then they got confident again about Europe and made a bunch of other trades that they thought would just balance out the first batch. But these things are very hard to fine tune, and they did a bad job of balancing them, or maybe they went overboard the second time and thought, not only do we want to get rid of those risk-reducing trades, we want to even go further and add risk. But that was the result. But anyway, I think you know, that it's, I mean, it's all there in J.P. Morgan's computers, and Jamie knows his job is hanging on a prompt, full exposition of it. So I think we'll get that.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about J.P. Morgan Chase admitting to a massive multi-billion-dollar trading loss because of wagers gone wrong by its in-house trading operations. Today, Jamie Dimon, the bank's chief executive, is facing shareholders at the company's annual meeting. President Obama and the Republican challenger Mitt Romney have weighed in on this, saying very different things. The president saying that this needs to be investigated, Mitt Romney is saying that there will be companies that will take risks and that this is a free market. The free market needs to let this play out. What do you think? What are your questions about all of this? We'll take more in a moment. Let me tell you that our guests are eminently qualified. Roger Lowenstein, columnist for Bloomberg, author of The End of Wall Street and When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management. Mark Williams, executive in residence, master lecturer at Boston University School of Management. He is a former Federal Reserve Bank examiner. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, the author of Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Scott Ferris will be with us. And we do want to say that Mark Williams has a book, too, which I don't think I've mentioned before. He is the author of Uncontrolled Risk, Lessons of Lehman Brothers and How Systemic Risk Can Still Bring Down the World Financial System. Ann in Madison, our next caller. Hi, Ann.
Right. Well, it's kind of obscene that these same banks who were gambling with everybody else's money have managed not to pay any tax, any federal taxes. And yet they know, and Obama hinted at it yesterday, that the public will bail them out again if things get really bad. But my question was, do antitrust laws apply to these huge behemoth banks? And obviously they're not being enforced if they do, or are antitrust laws of individual countries negated by these free trade agreements and the World Trade Organization and all this globalization that's caused this problem so that we have a monoculture financially as well as in every other way?
Mark, you want to start?
Well, to give you a background, I'm not a lawyer, so let me preface that. What I will say, in the United States, if we were to talk in 1980 about the number of banks, there are over 14,000 banks. Today, there's approximately 7,000 banks. So it's hard to really say that of these 7,000 banks that we have a monopoly or we have sort of anti-trade. But you could argue that the top five themselves control such a large percentage of the marketplace, over 60%, that would represent possibly too much market strength. That the Federal Reserve itself gives each bank a charter to give it the ability to actually be a bank. So really, we're at a point where the Fed and general policymakers need to think about what is the role, again, of commercial banks, and is that role to take in deposits and make loans, or is it, as we've talked about, to also be in the speculative trading industry? So I think that's really the nub of this whole discussion. There was a former Fed president from from the Kansas City Fed named Thomas Hogan, and he's actually specifically said that he feels that these big commercial banks should be out of the trading business. And I think that's very important, because that having a former Fed official say that at a very high level gets the debate really moving, I think, towards a policy such as that.
And who makes that kind of policy? How would that happen?
Well, it has to go through, in particular, through Congress. There has to be also a view, for example, with the Dodd-Frank bill in particular. There's a lot of discussion about what is the role of banks and how will they be regulated. And then going forward, what is the Fed's role in approving new bank charters and what will these banks be able to do?
Mm-hmm.
For example, do we need a new Glass-Steagall Act? It was repealed in 1999. Clearly, we realized that, and it took us a decade to realize it, that the Glass-Steagall Act probably should not have been repealed. That is, commercial banks should have remained sleepy and boring, and that the trading organizations of investment banks, the speculative organizations, should have been separated. It's sort of like the way I describe it. It's, it's like a guardrail. You know, you had a guardrail on this curve in the road. There were no accidents, and you just assumed that meant you didn't need a guardrail. And clearly, when they pulled the Glass-Steagall Act away, and they put in together investment banks and commercial banks, at that point, we realized 2008 that there was a great risk.
Roger.
First, I just want to correct what might be a misimpression, which is banks like JPM pay billions in taxes every year. So some corporations don't, but I don't know of a profitable bank that doesn't. I think the law right now says they can't own more than or collect more than 10% of the deposits in the country. That's the, in effect, the antitrust standard. And you know, this gets to a point that Mark raised. On the one hand, we don't want banks getting too big and too concentrated, and they've gotten. We have many fewer banks now than we used to. On the other hand, we want financial institutions. And I've asked Jamie Dimon this question. He said, "Look, did you want America to have big, strong banks on the same level that the Germans do, that the Japanese do, and now that the Chinese do?" The rest of the world, actually, their banking systems are much more concentrated than ours because America had this legacy of individual state banks. And you know, until you know a generation ago, there were no banks that crossed state lines. And in the last generation, as we've permitted acquisitions across state lines, you know, we have many fewer banks, but we still have more than other countries. So there's, I think, two sides to this coin.
Thanks, Ann, for the call. Ernest in Hayward. Hi.
Hi. It seems like Wall Street risk-taking is based on a foundation of government guarantees, and I don't mean just the bailouts, but the implicit guarantees of government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the explicit guarantees of FDIC-insured bank deposits. So why not replace the government guarantees with market guarantees, get the government out, and then we won't have to come in with taxpayer money?
Well, in the case of these giant institutions, there's no one else, in fact, you know, who's big enough to do it. In fact, in the case of AIG, which was, you know, the largest check that the government had to write, well, I guess except for Fannie and Freddie, but in the case of AIG, the Federal Reserve tried to get a private bailout. They got J.P. Morgan and Goldman and a few other of these banks in a room and said, you know, you guys put together a bailout for AIG, and you know the word came back, no thanks, we just can't do it. So, you know, that's where the impetus and with Fannie and Freddie, they had a statutory link to the government. There was no question of a private market bailout there, and they were way too huge. So that's where the sentiment comes back from on the other side. Maybe instead of trying to figure out what rules will make these banks safe and parse through all this, maybe it would be better just to say, look, let's make them small or smaller or small enough so that we can survive if they fail, and then we'll just go about our business. And that's, you know, I think there's a compelling argument for that. Just say to, you'd have to say to, say, J.P. Morgan, you bought WaMu, you're going to give that up. You know, you're in California and New York. You know, let's pick one and sell the other, and you know, get a lot smaller. You know, I would say that the banks of the size we have now, say J.P. Morgan, it would have to get a lot smaller. I mean, a lot smaller before it wouldn't be too big to fail. You know, the Federal Reserve was worried about Bear Stearns, you remember, and organized the bailout of that in 2008, and Bear Stearns was, you know, way, way smaller than the Goliath we have now. So we may be stuck with too big to fail, whether we like it or not.
Mm. You know, that film, one of my absolute favorites, It's a Wonderful Life, keeps running through my mind as we're talking, and I keep thinking, oh, how far away we are from
daily
savings
from
and loan, aren't we?
Right.
We're really a long
way from Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, it's really hard to even think about that. Ernest, thanks for the call. We're out of time. That's too bad. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. What, as the week progresses here, what should we keep our eyes and ears out for?
Well, I think you really want to look at Europe, what's happening in Europe. Importantly, that link between Europe, the strength and weakness, and also their banks. could be actually a precursor to the strength and weaknesses of the U.S. economy.
Hmm.
If it, or Europe goes into a true tailspin, then we'll see much more weakness in our stock market. Bank stocks will continue to be plummeled, and then we'll have much concern here in the U.S.
Hmm. Thank you both. You were just wonderful guests. Thank you. I think I understand things a little bit better, which is the purpose of talking.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our guest, Mark Williams, executive in residence, master lecturer at Boston University School of Management, a former Federal Reserve Bank examiner and author of Riskless, Uncontrolled Risk, Lessons of Lehman Brothers and How Systemic Risk Can Still Bring Down the World Financial System. Roger Lowenstein, columnist for Bloomberg, author of The End of Wall Street and When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for production assistance, and thanks to Rhonda for on-air production. We'll continue to talk about those guys, and they are guys who didn't win the presidency but made long-lasting contributions.